It was really quite an extraordinary experience for me to be under the Bodhi tree. So some people here also shared that experience. We're at that convention. And though I'd been to India before, I'd never actually visited Bodh Gaya or the site of the Bodhi tree where the Buddha gained illumination. Illumination, sorry, that's Spanish. Enlightenment. Well, illumination, it works, doesn't it? So we were on our order convention. There was more than 500. There were more than 500 members of we were at that point the Western Buddhist Order, now known as the Triratna Buddhist Order. But there were over 500 of us there. There were people from India, people from Australia, America, Europe, including the UK. So there were the Americas, there were Mexicans, there were Canadians, I believe, there were North Americans. So it was really a fantastic kind of cultural mix. And there were men and women. And it was quite an extraordinary experience to just be there together under the Bodhi tree meditating. We're a community. And there was just something about it for me which really brought home to me the radical nature of our community in terms of traditional Buddhism. And one of the things that was quite amazing was seeing Indian women leading events for men and women, Eastern, Indian and non-Indian, under the Bodhi tree. It's fantastic. I wonder if any other community is likely to have to offer that experience. And I felt so moved watching some of our own Indian Dharmacharinis, particularly who I know, who just, you know, doing that, actually taking that space under the Bodhi tree. It was a very, very significant experience for us. So, and something about that actual tree sitting there. Of course, it's not the tree that the Buddha gained enlightenment underneath, but it is an ancestor, I mean the opposite, a descendant of that tree. So it has come just in the same way as dependent origination. In dependence upon previous Bodhi trees have arisen, Bodhi trees that have given birth to this particular Bodhi tree, which I believe is in the region of 300 years old. Which actually for a Scot, that doesn't seem that old for a tree actually. We have older trees than that in Scotland. But it's still pretty significant as a tree. And many of you have probably had that experience of being there and sitting under the Bodhi tree. But I actually found it, in some ways I felt my devotion towards the tree. I was quite surprised actually how devotional I actually felt there. And it brought home to me, well, you know, people were saying, oh, it's amazing we're walking where the Buddha actually walked. And there was something about that that was extraordinary. But for me, there was actually something about the tree itself. And actually, just being able to be underneath this tree. For some reason, the tree moved me more than anything else. So when Samachitta asked me if I would be able to give a talk today to celebrate Wesak, celebrate the enlightenment of the Buddha, that image came very strongly to me, that image of being in Bodh Gaya and sitting underneath the Bodhi tree. So it is rather lovely to be standing underneath this tree to give a talk. So what I want to do is tell the story a little bit of the lead up to the Buddha's enlightenment experience, not very much. Then a little bit about that experience and a little bit about some of the events that happened just after the Buddha's enlightenment. So the weeks just after the Buddha's enlightenment. As Samachitta says, I wasn't very clear how I was going to fit in preparation for this talk. And on Friday evening, I saw Bhante, popped in to see Bhante, and I said to him, oh, I've got to give a talk on Sunday, and I haven't written it yet, and give me some ideas. So he did. So the talk you're getting is actually directly inspired by my conversation with Bhante on Friday night. And there's a couple of points particularly where I'll tell you specifically what he said to me at that point in the conversation. So the lead up to the Buddha's enlightenment. So I'll take it for granted that most of you know the story. So just to remind you and put you in the mood, you'll remember that the Buddha to be, not yet the Buddha, Siddhartha, had quite a leisurely life. And then at some particular point in that, he saw what we know as the four sights. Now, I believe you're going to explore that dramatically later on. So I won't say very much about that. But the Buddha-to-be, Siddhartha, he went out with his charioteer. Now, we don't know if it was in one occasion or different occasions. The scriptural references vary. But anyway, at some point he saw a sick man, an old man, a corpse. And these three sights in particular had a massive effect on the psyche of this young prince, as it were, this young man who'd had a fairly sheltered life, it would seem. Now, we can take it literally that he had never up until that point seen these sights. He'd never before seen an old person, he'd never before seen a sick person, and he'd never before seen a corpse. My own inclination, without necessarily wanting to psychologise the story, is to think that maybe he'd seen that before, but it had never quite impacted. I'm sure we've all had that experience of something that's quite commonplace in a way, for some reason, really hits us differently. Now, it might be that sometimes we know about death, but until we actually experience the death of somebody we love, it really doesn't impact on us in quite the same way. You know, illness, we know about illness. We get ill, we get sick. But until either we are told that we have some life-threatening illness or we're living alongside someone with that, you know, and as we all get a little bit older, we find ourselves in the situation often. Many of my friends are in a situation where they're nursing elderly parents, where they're looking after people who are quite sick. Some people for work do that, but sometimes you just see something again and again, and yet it takes, for some reason, someday it just goes in differently. So my own inclination is to think that probably that's what's meant by that bit of the story, that he saw, as though it were for the first time, death, as though it were for the first time, sickness, as though it were for the first time, old age. And the important thing seems to be that he not only saw that, but he realised, questioned his charioteer, his friend, will this happen to me? And that maybe is where the difference lies, that at that moment he realised this was not an abstract thing that was going to happen to other people, but something that at some point would or could happen to him. I mean, I say could because illness isn't guaranteed, but of course the other ones are guaranteed. Well, old age isn't guaranteed either, if we're lucky to have old age, but certainly death is guaranteed. And then, of course, there was the fourth sight, when he saw someone in the robe with a bowl of a wanderer, of a mendicant. And what that fourth sight said to him was that there was another way of living. There was the possibility of another way of life. And that and other things brought our young hero, as it were, to the point of deciding to leave home, to go off to seek a way out of suffering. Now, he did that not only for himself, but he makes it very clear that he does this because he wants to seek a way out of suffering for all beings. He sees that all beings, all humans are affected, all beings are affected by this suffering, by this manifestation of suffering as old age, sickness and death. But he sees that in many ways suffering is there. He also, you might recall, has a memory of when he was a child, and he was watching his father's ploughman plough the earth, and he sees the displacement. He remembers having seen the displacement of many insects and little wild, you know, creatures, and he realises that in some ways we're also like that. The ground is constantly being churned up from beneath us. There is no security in the things in which we often seek security. So he goes forth, to use that expression. He practices for around 6 years. He practices all sorts of austerities, all sorts of spiritual practices. And he makes great spiritual progress, but at the end he feels that something has not yet quite been broken through. And he has another memory from his childhood, which is he remembers the experience of sitting under the rose apple tree and entering into a state of bliss, probably a dhyanic state, a state of meditative calm, but quite spontaneously. And he remembers this and he feels this is the way to go. So he wants to sit under the tree And he takes some rice and some milk from a local, a girl in the vicinity, a cow herd, I believe she is, or a sheep herd. And he decides that he will sit under the Bodhi tree. And he sits under the Bodhi tree until he gains enlightenment. So I'd like to read you just a little bit. So he says, "Now, when I had eaten solid food and had regained my strength, then quite secluded from sensual desire, secluded from unprofitable things, I entered upon and abode in the fifth meditation. With the stilling of thinking and exploring, I entered upon and abode in the second meditation. With the fading as well of happiness, I abode in equanimity, mindful and fully aware. And I entered thus upon and abode in the third meditation, referring to which the noble ones announce, 'He has a pleasant abiding who looks on with equanimity and is mindful.' I entered upon and abode in the fourth meditation, which has neither pain nor pleasure, and the purity of whose mindfulness is due to onlooking equanimity. When my concentrated mind was thus purified, bright, unblemished, and rid of perfection, I directed and inclined my mind to the recollection of past life. I recollected my manifold past lives, many ages of world expansion, of world contraction and expansion." He goes into some detail here about how I appeared here and such a race, etc. And then he says, "Thus, with details and particulars, I recollected my manifold past lives. This was the first true knowledge attained by me. Ignorance was banished and true knowledge arose. Darkness was banished and light arose, as happens in one who is diligent, ardent and self-controlled." He then goes on to talk about what happens in the next period. "I inclined my mind to the knowledge of the passing away and reappearance of creatures." There's then quite a description of that, and he says at the end of that description, "I understood how creatures pass according to their actions. This was the second true knowledge attained by me in the second watch of the night. Ignorance was banished and true knowledge arose. Darkness was banished and light arose, as happens in one who is diligent, ardent and self-controlled." He goes on, he says, "I inclined my mind to the knowledge of exhaustion of taints. I had direct knowledge, as it actually is, of that is suffering, this is the origin of suffering, this is the cessation of suffering, and this is the path that leads to the cessation of suffering. My heart was thus liberated from the taints of sensual desire, of being and of ignorance. And there came the knowledge, it is liberated, I have direct knowledge. Birth is exhausted, the holy life has been lived, what has to be done is done." So what we have there, in a sense, is a conceptual explanation. But it's worth just remembering that although that's quite a lot of words, what it is a retrospective explanation of the Buddha's actual experience. So it would seem that under the Bodhi tree, he experienced liberation. The flavour of that experience was true liberation. He broke free. He broke through the things that kept him bound to a smaller existence, the things that kept him bound to the me of the subjective, small kind of ego-based existence. And the words and concepts are there to help us understand what that experience consisted of. But it's worth remembering that it was actually an experience. So it would seem that it was an experience that, and on a conceptual level, what he saw through was the arising and the falling away of conditioned existence, of conditioned phenomena. And he saw that, first of all, in terms of his own personal life. Now, whether or not he actually saw in, you know, the year, whatever, I lived in this place and I was called that, and which is how it's described in the text, perhaps he did see that. But it seems to me that the important thing is that he saw that through the personal life of a human being, there is a process of arising, passing away, arising and passing away. And he saw that first as an individual, and he then saw that in the second watch of the night as something of a process which arises and which falls, not only in the life of an individual person, but in life itself. So in a way, all life is arising. All conditioned existence is arising and falling. That's what he saw. So first he saw it in a personal sense, and then he saw it in the broader sense. He saw that as the law which applies to all conditioned existence. And he therefore saw himself as free from the taints of self-clinging, of ego, of greed, hatred and delusion. So then we're told that the Buddha, now a Buddha, now awakened, sat on under the Bodhi tree. Now, it would seem that he sat there for 7 weeks. So again, whether this is literal or whether it's a kind of a long time, I'm not completely sure. I don't think actually there is any way of being completely sure. Scholars amongst you might be able to correct me on that, but as far as I'm aware, it's, he sat there. He didn't immediately get up and rush off. And that's quite interesting. It was like he needed time to absorb the experience. Now, I'm sure all of us have had experiences, perhaps in meditation or in retreats, sometimes just experiences in life, which take some absorption. And one of the difficulties often of the kind of lives that most of us lead is that there's very little time sometimes for that kind of absorption period to happen. So that's just interesting that the Buddha, having had such a massive experience, then needed the time and the space and the possibility of absorbing that experience. And in, as he sat there, we're told, he felt the bliss of the emancipation. So remembering that this is an experience. And again, I'm sure we all know the experience of sometimes becoming free from something that we felt trapped by. Whether it's a negative mental state that's maybe haunted us for a while, or something external that's not going very well and that we find ourselves telling stories about and getting very, very caught up in. And then either through meditation or through working on that, or sometimes inexplicably, we manage to break free of it. And my goodness, what a relief. I mean, I don't know if anybody else understands that experience, but I've certainly had the experience of feeling rather trapped in a negative mental state, then managing to get rid of it, and I feel like a new woman. It really feels like I have, you know, let go of shackles. So if we can imagine that experience, you know, multiplied by who knows how much, the Buddha's experience of breaking free of all shackles, of true and complete emancipation. And he felt he was free from greed, hatred and delusion. He sat there in complete equanimity. So think of that. Absolutely nothing could bother him anymore. Which doesn't mean that nothing was of importance, but nothing could perturb his mind. I mean, again, I don't know if others have had this experience, I'm sure, but when you've come back from a retreat, perhaps, and you're really chilled, really calm, it's been a fantastic retreat, meditation's been spacious, you kind of think, why was I all wound up before? How foolish. And you come back, and sometimes it takes 5 minutes, Sometimes it might take a bit longer. Sometimes it even takes weeks. But quite often, at the end of that, something happens that does indeed perturb our peace of mind. So we can remember what that feels like, that feeling of nothing perturbing, nothing disturbing our peace of mind. Then we can again maybe get a sense of what the Buddha felt, that that was absolute, that was not, he was imperturbable. The image is sometimes used of a mountain peak. So it's as though the Buddha sat there like a mountain, and that mountain peak was touched by fluffy white clouds. Well, the fluffy white clouds just pass by. They have no detrimental effect whatsoever. So the Buddha's peace cannot be disturbed. The newly enlightened Buddha is a peaceful Buddha, a Buddha full of peace. And then various things occur, and the stories take us, there's lots of things occur, and I can't go through all of them, but I do want to talk about a couple of episodes that happened just after this enlightenment experience. So at some point, after he's sat there for a while, the Buddha gets up and he walks. I've read somewhere it was 50 metres. I don't know how anybody knows it was 50 metres. But anyway, he walks away from the tree and he turns back round. He looks at the tree and he bows to the tree. I love this episode. I think it's really beautiful. And what he's expressing in this is his gratitude to the tree. The scriptures tell us, he gazes unblinkingly. There's actually, for those of you who've been to Bodh Gaya, there is a spot there which is the Animisha spot, the unblinking spot, from which apparently the Buddha stood and looked back unblinkingly at the Buddha, at the Bodhi tree. And so he gazes in gratitude, we're told, which is, you know, why would he gaze in gratitude at a tree? Well, I suppose he gazes in gratitude because it had sheltered him and supported him. Now, it's a number of things that are interesting about that. One is that the Buddha did not see that tree as a dead and inanimate object, but presumably saw the life in that tree. The Buddha could respond to that. You know, you do get in some of the scripture. Oh, wait a minute. So you do find in some of the early Pali canon the idea of evoking the spirits of the trees or the land, or, you know, the deities that abide in the land or the trees. And how literally we take that, I suppose the point is that we've been asked to see the universe as a living universe, not as dead and inanimate, but as a universe with life pulsing through, life that we participate in, but that takes many, many forms. So, but also I suppose the tree was for the Buddha a symbol of everything and everybody that had supported him in his quest. So this was when I had the conversation with Bhante on Friday night. This was the point he was very keen to have made, was, as he put it, the newly enlightened Buddha was a grateful Buddha. So the Buddha had gratitude. And Bhante, you know, those of you who have had conversations with Bhante about this kind of thing, when he gets a theme that gets on a roll with, he can tell you a lot about that theme. And he got on a roll about gratitude, which I won't, you know, try and recreate. But, you know, he did say that when, you know, he wonders sometimes about Western culture's approach to gratitude. And we talked a little bit about the difference between the East in India and outside India in that sense. And of course, you can't, comparisons in some ways are foolish. But my own experience is when I've been in India, for example, when I've, travelled around some of our projects in India, that people are extraordinarily grateful. But it's not just that they're grateful because, you know, of charity or because of, something external. It's a real deep gratitude to having made such massive changes in their life. But it's just a kind of, there's just seems to be an ease of expressing gratitude, which I sometimes feel we don't always find so easy in our own cultural milieu to express gratitude. And when the Buddha thought afterwards of teaching, Banti made the point that, when he thought of who he could go and talk to, who could he share this experience with of enlightenment, this insight that he had gathered? Well, the first people that came to mind were the teachers that he had had and the companions that he had had in his quest. And Banti made the point that that might have been because he thought they would understand him because they were on a spiritual quest. But he also wondered if it was also a sense of gratitude because they had helped him so much on his path that there was a natural sense of they would be the first people he would want to go back and share that with. So I thought that was quite interesting. And gratitude would seem to be a very strong part of the Buddhist teaching. In the Mangala Sutta, gratitude is one of the signs of spiritual progress. So I just think it's worth remembering that. And, personally, I have a lot of gratitude to Banti, to Sangharakshita. I have a lot of gratitude to other members of the Order. I've got a lot of gratitude to, it's once you start to kind of try and move into that mindset, it's infinite, isn't it? You know, we're sitting here in this beautiful garden. You know, we can be so thankful to the people that maintain this garden, the people that maintain the Buddhist Centre, the people that are willing to just, you know, keep coming and who contribute, whether it's economically or whether it's in terms of their time. There's so much we can be grateful for. We've got Virya Leela sitting there who's works for Free Buddhist Audio. You know, I just think Free Buddhist Audio is such a fantastic resource. This is not only a plug, it's a little plug. But actually, as I travel, one of the things I do in my work is I travel around our centres, all around the globe actually. I'm incredibly fortunate. And when I go to places like Australia and New Zealand, people use Free Buddhist Audio so, it's such a part of their practice. They can listen to the talk that Padmavajra just gave at Padmaloka last week. They can listen to the talk that Banti gave somewhere. They can, you know, it's really a fantastic resource, and people have their iPods with nothing on it except Free Buddhist Audio. They have Free Buddhist Audio iPods, and, you know, just really are able to keep up to date with what's been said, what's been thought about, and also to go back to some of Banti's very early talks and teachings, which is a real treat, actually, sometimes, to be able to listen to some of those old talks. So there's so much we can be grateful for. We can be grateful for, well, it's infinite, isn't it? And the word that's been translated here as gratitude is katanyuta. Kata means what has been done, with the implication of what has been done for one, for oneself. And anuta, knowing or recognising. So this state of gratitude is a knowing or recognising of what has been done for us. And apparently, akatanyuta, or the lack of gratitude, or ingratitude, is one of the four great offences. So it's a great offence to not feel gratitude. Now, I'm saying, in a way, you can't make people feel gratitude, can you? I can't say, feel gratitude, you know. It doesn't work like that. In fact, probably if I come up to you and say, well, you ought to feel gratitude, you're going to go, whoa, you know. So I'm really not, I hope it doesn't sound like a harangue, because it's not what I mean. It's more that just, I find it very inspiring to think that the Buddha's first act on gaining enlightenment was a gesture of gratitude. And that sometimes I have come across people who have said to me, actually, that expression of gratitude is almost a bit humiliating. And I think, well, A, what's up with humility, you know? But B, why would it be humiliating to express gratitude? Presumably it's because if I express gratitude to someone, I'm beholden in some way, or I put myself under, or I think that other person's better or something. And actually, it seems to me that gratitude is just a very natural connecting emotion. Something has happened, something has been done for me, I've had something given to me, or I feel gratitude. And I think, in a way, it's what keeps a flow happening. Because if I can feel gratitude, then it's almost as though I then open up and more can happen. More can come in. You know, we don't close off. Gratitude keeps something open. If we can't feel gratitude, we can't really receive anything else. It's like it blocks something. And again, in my own kind of work, if that's the right term for it, I am incredibly privileged to also be a public preceptor, which means that I have the great privilege of bestowing, it says in the ceremony, which sounds very grand, bestowing the kesa. So there's a particular point in the ceremony of ordination where I get to put a kesa around somebody's neck, and it's a great thing to do. I recommend it, highly recommend it. And people are just so grateful. But the beautiful thing is they're not grateful to me. Because, I mean, I'm bestowing a kesa, but actually, you know, it's the kesa almost that they're grateful to. It's the fact of, it's the membership of a community. It's the coming into alignment with something bigger than themselves. It's Sangharaksha that they feel grateful to. It's the Buddhist tradition. It's the Buddha. And I'm very privileged in that moment to stand in a space that allows me to mediate that gratitude. And it's beautiful. It's very beautiful. The other thing that we bestow in an ordination ceremony is a private preceptor bestows a name, which is actually a bit scary. It's a bit scary for the person getting the name. But believe me, it's also a bit scary giving them, because you kind of think you're going to stick this person with a moniker for life, you know, which they might absolutely hate. So far, touch wood, I've done all right. Nobody's hated the names I've given them, but there's always that little worry. I suppose that just came to my mind, is things where I'm very aware of people expressing gratitude, and I'm very aware of the non-personal aspect of it, that it's something almost transpersonal. And of course it's personal because I'm in that relationship. But one of the things I find very exciting about that is that it transcends the personal while happening in a personal relationship. Anyway, I have rather wandered away from the Bodhi tree, rather wandered away from the Buddha's enlightenment experience, but perhaps not so far, because gratitude, I'm trying to express something of that gratitude. Also, if we don't realise the value of something, we can't use it properly. So I wonder as well if in that moment of the Buddha expressing his gratitude to the Bodhi tree, he was also expressing something of a knowledge of the importance of the experience that he had had, a gratitude to everything that had brought him to that moment. And then what happens afterwards kind of comes out of that moment. So that gratitude's almost the fulcrum moment out of which something new will arise. So I want to read you very briefly another little bit of something else that happens as the Buddha sits under the Bodhi tree. So this is a very well-known episode in the Enlightenment story. Now, while the Blessed One was alone, this thought arose in him. This law that I have attained is profound and hard to see, hard to discover. It is the most peaceful and superior goal of all, not attainable by mere ratiocination on attachment, subtle for the wise to experience. And then he says, so remember he's talking 2,500 and more years ago, as you hear this statement, ask yourself, has this changed? The Buddha says, but this generation relies on attachment, relishes attachment, delights in attachment. It is hard for such a generation to see the truth. That is to say, the truth of dependent arising. If I taught the law, others would not understand me, and that would be wearing and troublesome for me. So this is the famous episode where the Buddha looks around and he wonders if actually anyone will grasp this teaching which he has come to through hard work and great effort. So as you probably know, what happens then is that Brahma Sahampati, who is a figure that I don't know quite what he represents, but in this particular episode, let's say he represents the highest in humanity, coming to plead, as it were. So we're told, it occurred to Brahma Sahampati, the world will be lost, the world will be utterly lost, for the mind of the perfect one favours inaction and not teaching the law. So Brahma Sahampati comes to the Buddha and he says, Lord, let the blessed one teach the law, let the sublime one teach the law. There are creatures with little dust in their eyes who are wasting through not hearing the law. Some of them will gain final knowledge of the law. So the Blessed One listened to Brahma Sahampati's pleading. Out of compassion for creatures, he surveyed the world with the eye of an enlightened one. Just as in a pond of blue, red or white lotuses, some lotuses are born and grow in the water, thrive in the water without coming out of it. Other lotuses are born and grow in the water and come to rest on the water's surface. Some other lotuses come right up out of the water and stand clear. He saw too that there were creatures with little dust and creatures with much dust, with keen faculties and dull faculties, easy to teach and hard to teach. And so he said, wide open are the portals of the deathless. Let those who hear show faith. If I was minded to tell not the sublime law, it was that I saw vexation in the telling. And Brahma Sahampati thought, I have made it possible for the law to be taught. So thank you, Brahma Sahampati. So a little bit of gratitude there maybe for Brahma Sahampati for having asked the Buddha to teach. And so we could say that the newly enlightened Buddha is also a compassionate Buddha. So compassion arises in his heart and he's willing to teach. And then another episode happens, which I want to talk about fairly briefly. So this episode is found in a sutta called the Garava Sutta, or the Garava Sutta. And the sutta says, I have heard that on one occasion, when the Blessed One was newly awakened, he was staying at Uruvela on the bank of the river, at the foot of the banyan tree. While he was alone and in seclusion, this line of thinking arose in his awareness. One suffers if dwelling without reverence or deference. Now, on what priest or contemplative can I dwell in dependence, honouring and respecting him? I won't read the whole sutra. So, the interesting thing here is that the Buddha seemed to feel a human need to revere, to have some object of reverence, something of devotion, as though he needed something or someone to look up to. So from a certain point of view, the Buddha's at the pinnacle of human experience. The Buddha has achieved, he has broken free of all the restraints. He's a liberated, emancipated, newly awakened being. But he doesn't say, I have arrived, it's over. He looks for something or someone to look up to revere. So again, it would seem that the newly enlightened Buddha is a worshipping Buddha. And that's also rather interesting. So as the sutra goes on, the Buddha explains what he would be looking for in this object of reverence. So he would be looking for a way of perfecting what are known in this sutra as the five aggregates. I'm not going to go into much detail about that. But it's basically a list that we're probably familiar with. It's the list of virtue or shila, ethics, samadhi or meditation, wisdom. In this particular translation, it's translated as discernment, but it's wisdom. And then release or emancipation. And then fifthly, the knowledge and vision of that release. So it's quite a well-known grouping of five. We find quite often in the Pali Canon. Anyway, he looks around him and he doesn't in fact find immediately anyone that he thinks or any way that he can see of perfecting more of his Shila meditation and wisdom. He has had the experience of release and he has had the cognitive acknowledgement of that release. So he's kind of left wondering where to turn to. And what he says then is he says, what if I were to dwell on this very Dhamma to which I have fully awakened, honouring and respecting it? So he sees as he looks around that where his, what can be the object of his devotion, of his honour and his respect, is the Dhamma. So before I say a bit more about what that might mean, the sutra carries on with Brahma Sahampati again, appearing, he seems to kind of appear and disappear quite a lot during these early days after the enlightenment. Anyway, he comes, he salutes the Blessed One and he says, so it is, Blessed One, so it is. Those who were awakened in the past, those who will be awakened in the future, and you awakened in the present, all dwell in dependence on this very Dhamma itself, honouring and respecting it. Let the Blessed One, the rightly self-awakened one, dwell in dependence upon the very Dhamma itself, honouring and respecting it. So, Brahma Sahampati, I suppose he represents something of an affirmation of the principle. An affirmation of the principle that, yes, the Buddha is right. That it's almost as though Buddhahood, by its very nature, worships the Dhamma. That is an intrinsic part of the awakening experience, is to recognise the Dhamma. Now, in this sense, it's not that he worships the Dharma as teaching, which is how we usually talk over experience the Dharma, because of course he hadn't yet done any teaching. He's still sitting under the Bodhi tree. So he isn't saying, oh, I'll reverence my formulation of the Four Noble Truths, or I'll reverence my own cognitive understanding of something. What he's actually reverencing, honouring, respecting, is the law of conditionality itself. It's Dhamma as principle. It's the Dhamma that he has awakened to. So if you remember the description of that experience that he had, was he saw the arising and the falling of his own being, and he saw the arising and falling of all beings. So the enlightenment experience is an experience of a natural law. It's of the natural law of conditioned co-production, of conditionality, of dependent arising. So he's recognising that principle as being the law that has made him a Buddha. So he's recognising, in this honour and respect, we could say that he's respecting the principle by virtue of which it was possible for him and for any human being to attain enlightenment. So there's a kind of rather neat logic in the honouring of that principle. And it's like he's had this experience and he honours the principle by which he's been able to have that experience. So it's like the medium and the message are as one in a sense in this moment. And one way of thinking about that is to think of the Dhamma here as the Dhamma Niyama. So there's a list of five Niyamas, which are not in fact found in the Pali Canon. They're later, they're quite a lot later. But Bhante Sangharakshita has found them very useful. And frankly, personally, I've found it a really useful list. So although it's not found in quite this traditional five-fold formulation in the Pali Canon, it's a way of unpacking a principle which is very clearly found in the Pali Canon, this principle of conditionality. So the five niyamas are the law of conditionality, the principle of arising, the fact that all phenomena arise in dependence upon conditions, And with the cessation of those conditions, the phenomena ceases to exist, the phenomenon ceases to exist. That law works itself out in different spheres or in different levels. Levels isn't quite right. Spheres is probably better. So it works itself out on the physical inorganic level. It works itself out on the physical organic level. Works itself out in the sphere of the mind, kind of psychological. It works itself out in the ethical plane, which is the level of karma and karma vipaka. And it also works itself out on the spiritual or transcendental level, which is the Dhamma Niyama. So I'm not going to say much about that. Bhante's talked about it in quite a few places. It's been looked at in lots of places. But where I personally have particularly found this a very helpful teaching is in a kind of unpacking of a very unsophisticated and, to my mind, even marginally dangerous understanding of karma, where something happens and there's an assumption made from a certain understanding of karma that everything that's happened is due to karma. So while it would be true to say that any phenomenon that occurs is due to conditionality, we don't actually always know on what level of conditionality the thing is working itself out. So a very crude and rather horrible example was that I heard a while ago from a friend in India that two of our very well-known and loved order members were died in a car crash in India at the end of last year, the autumn of last year, something like that, September, October last year. Tragic event. Well, apparently some people, even in our order, were saying, oh, well, they must have had some very bad karma. It's such an unhelpful way to look at something like that. So who knows the conditions that came into play to make that particular event happen. But I think to draw back from any tragedy, anything, draw back from anything, and assume we know the cause of it, well, it's a philosophical fallacy for one thing, but I think it's dangerous for another. You can't actually work back to cause from effect. You can't assume to be able to work back to cause from effect. You know, the classic thing that's given as an example here is if you have a cold, or a fever, rather. If you have a fever, you could have a fever because something's happening on the biological level. It's got nothing to do with your ethics at all. Or it could be on a psychological level. Sometimes things that happen to us psychologically, we somatize. They have an effect on the body. It could be an ethical question. It could be that something, some action that we've done, not necessarily a bad action, but some action has shaken our psyche in some way, and it becomes held in the body. It could even perhaps be in the level of Dhamma Niyama. It could be that we've had a dhyanic meditation, we've had an insight experience, and our body can't cope with it. You know, it's hard to, you can't really separate all these things. Anyway, the reason why I say all that is because I've personally found it a very helpful way of looking at karma, to kind of disassociate. Of course, the other side of that is that we must assume that anything that happens, even if it isn't the result of karma, depending on how we respond to it, will be the cause of karma. Yeah. So if I have a cold, it could have happened for any reason. If I get in a really, really bad mood and go about kicking the furniture because I've got a cold, that will have an effect. Don't look so puzzled. It might happen. Sometimes people get angry when they get ill. You know, that anger would have an effect on the mind, which would have an effect on other levels. And it could even mean that I go out in a blinding bad mood, I get in the car, and I hit something, and have an accident. You know, so conditionality works in quite complex ways. Anyway, so the Dhamma Niyama is this law of conditionality, this natural law that all arises in dependence upon conditions, working itself out in the spiritual or even the transcendental plane. And Bhante's talked about this in terms of something you'll be very familiar with, the wheel and the spiral. So we can look at conditionality in terms of a cyclic level of conditionality. If this isn't familiar material, I suggest you have a look at it. It's really exciting and it's very available. And then conditionality can also work in a more spiral way. So rather than independent, you know, with the cyclic, things just go round in a cycle, as it were. In the spiral, they augment each other. Conditionality is augmentative. So out of the fullness of a previous state arises a fuller state of mind, for example. And the Dhamma Niyama is particularly this spiral kind of conditionality, especially after the point on the spiral path of knowledge and vision of things as they really are. So we enter the terrain of the Dhamma Niyama, of the law of conditionality on the spiritual or transcendental plane, when we've broken through the things that hold us back. We've broken through our limited self-view, when we've broken through our dependence on rites and rituals to kind of give us a spiritual sense and identity of ourselves, and when we've broken through our doubt and indecision. So past that point, what's sometimes known or called as being in the stream of our practice, Bhante talks about this as the sum total of the spiritual law which governs progress through the stages of the spiritual path. So the Dhamma Niyama is that law of conditionality playing itself out in terms of our spiritual life, of our spiritual path. Anyway, there's lots we could say about it, but it's very hard to talk about the Dhamma Niyama without either falling into reifying or deifying it. What I mean is, it's hard to talk about these things without giving them capital letters, if you know what I mean, without calling them the transcendental or the absolute or the something or another. And one of the things about understanding this as a natural law is it helps us to break away from that tendency to capitalise, if you see, not to capitalise on it, but to create capital letters in the sentence. So it helps us to break away from that kind of human tendency to make it something. It's actually a dynamic principle. So there are other ways that we do sometimes talk about these things. It's the mystical aspect of our practice, the more numinous aspect of our practice. It's ineffable. And we studied this recently in our college meeting, because Subhuti had had some conversations with Bhante around some of these areas, which she then shared with us in the public preceptors meeting. And Subhuti said this statement, I think it was him, well, he certainly said it, I think it was original to him, but I thought it was great. He said, "The universe is such that stones fall to the ground and enlightenment is possible." I thought that was really great. It's like the law works itself out in all these different ways. And Manjivadra, another public preceptor who's a scientist, a physicist by background, he said, "Well, it's interesting, we would never think of not cooperating with the laws of physics. So why don't we cooperate with the laws of karma or with the laws of the Dhamma Niyama?" I thought it was a good question, actually. And in a way, what would that mean? Well, I suppose we don't try to defy the laws of gravity. Well, sometimes we do try to defy the laws of gravity, but we kind of know not to try and defy the laws of gravity. So that kind of natural law on that level, we know it's better to cooperate with it, don't we? And we can also learn how to, as it were, use it. So, for example, you can learn how to fall differently. We think of the law of gravity. You know, there are ways of falling, some of which will do you more harm than good, some of which won't do you any harm. So we can learn to, not exactly manipulate, but to align ourselves with the best of that law. Or we can learn how to throw something so that it, you know, uses the law of gravity to go as far as possible or as high as possible. So why not learn to use, as it were, the laws of conditionality in all those spheres? In other words, why not cooperate with the ethical laws? Why not cooperate with the fact that our actions will have consequences and therefore act in a way which will have the best possible consequences? It's kind of logical, really. It makes sense, doesn't it? You know it makes sense. So we could say that in terms of this Dhamma Niyama, although it's much more mysterious and harder to talk about, that we could decide that our spiritual practice is to align ourselves with that force, as it were, with that power, that law of conditionality working itself out in that sphere. That dynamic principle of self-transcendence. We can put ourselves in alignment. Another way of thinking of that, another way of putting that would be we can learn to put ourselves in alignment with the body-mind, the body-heart, with the bodhicitta. We can learn to live in ways that encourage the emergence of the body-mind rather than living in ways that detract from the body-mind. So we can learn to kind of put ourselves in alignment with that mysterious force that the Buddha experienced under the Bodhi tree. Subhuti also said in that study that the Dhamma Niyama is the level of conditionality implicit in reality which unfolds dynamically and which you as an individual can cooperate with but cannot command. In the end, it defies definition and we must speak of it as a mystery. I bring that in because I think if we think of something as a law, it's easy to fall into a mechanistic way of understanding it. And so then we almost reduce something which is ineffable and mysterious to something which is a law in a more mechanistic sense. And so I think to think that it's something we can cooperate with but we cannot command it is quite useful. Because actually, even though it's a natural law, we don't really know what that might mean. So even in terms of our actions having consequences, we can only ever act in good faith. Because the web of conditionality is so vast and complex that we can't ever really know exactly the effect our action will have. So all we can do is align ourselves to the best we can with that natural law. And the very attempt to command it, which is what we do, is the very attempt, is the very thing that constantly pushes us up against reality and the very reason why suffering is experienced. Because we're not living in harmony with that ineffable law, that arising and falling. We're trying so much to fix. We're thinking so much of the universe as me, 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 mine, mine, mine. You know that bit in Nemo? You know the film Nemo? No? Okay. Well, it's an animated cartoon and there's this bit in it where one of the creatures is going, me, 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 mine, 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 mine. And it's fabulous. I think of it quite often. When I'm in a particular mental state, I kind of hear the little Nemo voice in the background and I think, oh dear, I've tripped into that mind-making space. But I find the cartoon a better way of coming at it than Nagarjuna's more philosophical way. I kind of find it's a bit more, I can hang more loosely to it, you know, and think, oh yeah, okay, I've done it again. You know, Bhante Sangharakshita says somewhere the ego is nothing but a big mistake. So I think for me that ties in a bit with a kind of more cartoon version of it. That I'm just making a big mistake when I think the universe revolves around me. Because I suspect we're all making that same mistake because you think it revolves around you rather than me. Anyway, we cannot command this law, and yet we can cooperate with it. So this takes us back, this mystery perhaps takes us back to the Buddha under the Bodhi tree, to the mystery of that experience, to the wonder of what happened in that moment and its effect on humanity. We're sitting here in a beautiful sunny afternoon in the garden of the Birmingham Buddhist Centre. Now, how far away from Bodh Gaya might that seem? There's probably a song in there, from Bodh Gaya to Birmingham. It's a country and western, isn't it? It's from Bodh Gaya to Birmingham. I think it's actually from Boulder to Birmingham. But anyway, it works. So it's a long way. It seems like a big journey geographically. It seems like a big journey historically. It seems like a huge journey spiritually to be standing under whatever kind of tree this is, because I know nothing of trees. Sycamore tree, under a sycamore tree in a garden in Birmingham, and yet we can evoke and take our minds to that marvellous and mystical moment the mystery of what happened under the Bodhi tree. We're not so separate. We're human beings. We have aspirations. We have a desire to align ourselves with the forces of good. We're in the same space that the Buddha was in, the Buddha to be was in. We can really allow ourselves to be submerged and to be permeated by the wonder of that experience. So I'd like to end. Well, I'm going to end by reading a quote, another sutra, and then I'll just close off. So this is from the Samyutta Nikaya. The Buddha says, "So long, brethren, as the moon and the sun have not arisen in the world, just so long is there no shining forth of great light, no shining forth of great radiance. Gross darkness, the darkness of bewilderment, prevails. Neither night nor day is distinguishable, nor the month, nor the half month, nor the seasons of the year are to be discerned. But, brethren, when the moon and the sun arise in the world, then is the shining forth of great light, of great radiance. And gross darkness, the darkness of bewilderment, is no more. Then are distinguished the night and the day. Then are discerned the month and the half month and the seasons of the year. Just so, brethren, so long as a Tathagata has not yet arisen, an Arahant, a Buddha supreme, there is no shining forth of great light, of great radiance, and gross darkness, the darkness of bewilderment, prevails. There is no proclaiming, no teaching, no showing forth, no setting up, no making plain of the Four Noble Truths. But, brethren, as soon as the Tathagata arises, all these things take place, and then there is the proclaiming, the teaching, the showing forth, the making plain of the Four Aryan Truths." So in that moment under the Bodhi tree, the light shone, the darkness was eclipsed. Have any of you ever seen a full eclipse of the sun, experienced a full eclipse of the sun? It's an extraordinary experience, isn't it? And there's a moment I saw when the one that was in the 90s, late 90s, was it? I was in Cornwall, actually. And it was a full eclipse there. And I was looking over the sea. And there was just this moment where the shadow of the moon comes across the sun. But watching it on the sea, what happened was the sea, just this line of darkness raced across the sea. It was extraordinary. And everything went dark. It really did go dark. It went cold. And it was visceral. It was an experience that wasn't just, oh, this is jolly interesting. Look how dark it's become. I actually felt it viscerally. I felt the light went out. And you could really see why people who had no, you know, in earlier times when there was no scientific understanding of this experience, just to suddenly have the light go out like that. You know, the house I was staying in, there was a dog, and the dog went really quite freaked out by this and went off and went into her basket and was quite, you know, shaky. And then, however many minutes later, it felt like the sun came back. Of course, you know, the shadow moves across. And so then this line of light came racing across. What an experience. What a relief it felt like. And when I read that passage of the sun and the moon and the passage of the light of the Tathagata, I have that same experience. I have that same feeling that the world would be lost. And as we look around, it's so easy to see how easily the world can be lost. You know, what the Buddha said as he looked around him, this generation is fond of attachment. Well, I suspect, what would the Buddha say if he looked around now? He wouldn't say, oh, no probs, they've all broken through attachment. You know, absolutely no probs, there's no work for me here. I doubt it very much. You know, as we look around, we see the need for the light and the darkness. So today let us rejoice. I sound like I'm a preacher in a... It's because I'm outdoors, you know. So let us rejoice. You know, let's go back to that, the Buddha under the Bodhi tree. Let's remember that arising of the light. Let's really rejoice and feel gratitude in the qualities and the values that were represented by that earth-shattering moment. Let us really develop our gratitude, our compassion, our reverence and worship, our calm and our peacefulness. Not only so that we have a happier and better life, but for the benefit of all beings. So that all beings may be bathed in the light that arose and that shone in that moment of the enlightenment experience. When I went to Bodh Gaya in February 2009, I felt immense gratitude for the radical nature of our community and the radical nature of the Buddha's Dharma. So today in Wesak, I'd like to just finish by asking all of you to really rejoice, however, whatever that means for you, and maybe more importantly, to really make the most of the conditions that we have, of having found the Buddha's Dharma, of having had the experience of putting ourselves into that river of teaching that started to flow forth on the Buddha's enlightenment. So happy Wesak.
Thank you very much, Parami. That was a big talk, which can be summed up in a few words, but I'm just amazed that Parami's created that talk in the midst of her life. You know, she took us from the Bodhi tree in Bodh Gaya to the Bodhi tree centuries ago with the Buddha sitting under the Bodhi tree and evoked the night of the Buddha's enlightenment, and then took us through a whole teaching of, or a whole survey of the Buddha's teaching. survey of Buddhism, basically, yes. yes. And I mean, you know, she doesn't get anything for it. She doesn't have to do it. Nobody would have blamed Parami if she'd said, oh, no, I'm too busy. I'm fitting it in the middle of a busy day of meetings. She's done that, which she has to get back to, a few meetings, and then off she goes to Spain in a couple of days to perform more ordinations. So I just think we're very fortunate to have had yes, to have had Parami and Banti, his input via Parami today. So, you know, she's talked a lot about the quality of gratitude and katanyuta, which Parami's been embodying and rejoicing in. And I'm sure that that's been evoked in us as well. So, you know, I'd just like to express our gratitude to Parami once more.
Thank you very much. Have a smashing afternoon. I'm going to love yous and leave yous, actually.
Thank you, Parami. So what we've got next is time for tea. And
I always miss the fun bit.
Yeah, it's a shame. Tea and nibbles, and then in about half an hour, the bonfire will be lit. Just in case we get cold. And about 15 minutes after that, we'll start the outdoor performance. So enjoy. Bye.
Bye. Bye. Okay.